Disc 8.
Chapter 8.
Update. Since I began this book, much new information has surfaced concerning not only the lethal effects of excitotoxins on the nervous system, but also a growing list of ways to reduce the degree of such damage. It is obvious, despite denials from the food industry and its myriad supporters, that the scientific world is convinced that glutamate and aspartate are very toxic compounds to the nervous system. In fact, excessive excitotoxin accumulation within the injured brain constitutes the leading theory of a final common pathway for a multitude of disorders affecting the central nervous system, from strokes and trauma to neurodegenerative diseases and seizures. In fact, there is only one point of contention that remains to be settled. Do the excitotoxins pass through the blood-brain barrier? There is overwhelming evidence that both glutamate and aspartate can enter even the protected brain from the unprotected parts of the brain, via the circumventricular organs. In the developing baby, we know that not only does glutamate pass through the placental barrier into the baby's brain, but that drastic changes occur within the chemistry of the baby's immature brain that affect not only the child's future behavior and development, but also its capacity to learn complex information. I warn all pregnant women to avoid all forms of glutamate and aspartate, especially aspartame. We know that ingestion of aspartame dramatically increases brain levels of phenylalanine and methanol. Further, methanol is converted within the tissues of the brain into formic acid and formaldehyde, both powerful neurotoxins. So in the case of aspartame, we have two powerful neurotoxins plus a powerful excitotoxin, all rolled in one. Part 1. Pharmaceutical agents. Experimentally, numerous agents, APV, DAA, and DAP, for example, have been used to block glutamate toxicity. One of the most commonly used has been a compound designated MK-801. Interestingly, it not only reduces the toxicity of glutamate on NMDA receptors, but it also blocks the neurotoxicity of L-cysteine. This compound has been tested in both animals and humans with some significant success, but it has some unfortunate drawbacks. For one, it not only blocks toxicity, but it also blocks normal memory formation. Remember, glutamate is a neurotransmitter in the brain that initiates long-term potentiation in the temporal lobes, necessary for laying down new memories. MK-801 is a non-selective NMDA-type glutamate blocker. That is, it blocks pathological accumulation as well as normal levels of glutamate in brain tissue. Because of this problem, pharmaceutical researchers have been searching for new compounds that are more selective. The commonly used antitussive dextromethorphan is a moderately powerful NMDA-type glutamate blocker. I have used it successfully in a case of acute spinal cord disease. In a recent study of dextromethorphan used in surgical patients, clinicians at the Stanford Stroke Center found that using doses as high as 4 milligrams per kilogram body weight were not only safe, but they were able to attain brain levels that were significantly protective of the brain. In fact, brain levels were 68 times higher than serum levels. Neurological side effects were seen when using these high concentrations, but resolved completely when the drug was stopped. At lower doses, these patients experienced dizziness, slurring of speech, and loss of balance. Fatigue and hallucinations occurred with the highest doses. Again, all of these side effects subsided when the dextromethorphan was stopped. One of the most common side effects was a sense of euphoria, very similar to feeling drunk. Interestingly, ethyl alcohol is known to block NMDA-type glutamate receptors. The ability of ethanol to block LTP memory circuits may explain the memory blackouts seen in alcohol abuse. Some of the anti-Parkinson's drugs are also glutamate blockers, such as procyclidine and ethypropazine. There is growing evidence that excitotoxicity plays a key role in Parkinson's disease and that a successful therapy may be found utilizing a selective blockade of the involved glutamate receptors. In the early 70s, a new anesthetic, ketamine, was implemented for the purpose of light anesthesia. Unfortunately, the agent had serious drawbacks. Patients often had combative hallucinations. It is now known that ketamine is a powerful NMDA-type glutamate blocker. This disturbing side effect can be blocked using another drug called scopolamine. Ketamine may be useful in reducing the damaging effects of various types of brain trauma, including strokes. Another interesting compound, developed by the Wellcome Foundation Limited, designated 619C89, suppresses glutamate release from the injured brain and has far fewer psychomotor and behavioral side effects than earlier NMDA antagonists. In stroke experiments, this compound has been shown to suppress glutamate accumulation successfully within 30 minutes and continues to protect the brain for 24 hours. Not only is 619C89 safer, but it is also more effective in reducing toxic levels of glutamate and aspartate in strokes than is MK801 by almost a factor of 2. This compound holds great promise in reducing brain damage in strokes, subarachnoid hemorrhages, and brain trauma. But while 619C89 appears to be very effective in preventing the toxic accumulation of excitotoxins when their source is from within the brain itself, it would have little effect on excitotoxins entering the brain from the bloodstream. Several approaches to this problem are possible. We know that excitotoxins do their damage to brain cells by initiating a series of destructive reactions involving special fatty acids found within the cell membrane. The process begins with the release of arachidonic acid, which in turn passes through a series of enzymatic steps leading to the creation of a series of compounds known as eicosanoids. Not all eicosanoids are bad. Some serve useful purposes, such as improving blood flow, stimulating immune function, and reducing inflammation. The so-called bad eicosanoids have opposite effects. They can suppress immune function, impair blood flow, and promote inflammation. When the bad eicosanoids are produced in excess in brain cells, one can see cellular destruction, massive free radical formation, and withering of synaptic connections. We know that glutamate markedly increases the release of arachidonic acid, and likewise, arachidonic acid may enhance glutamate release from hippocampal nerve terminals. This produces a vicious cycle of destructive reactions within the cell. Fortunately, we have several drugs that can reduce the production of some bad eicosanoids. One of the most commonly used of these drugs is aspirin. Another group of compounds, called non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, also blocks some of these reactions. These include most of the commonly used arthritis drugs, such as ibuprofen. Glucocorticoids are some of the most powerful eicosanoid-blocking drugs known. By blocking bad eicosanoid production, one bypasses the negative effects of interfering with normal glutamate function. Unfortunately, the available drugs do not selectively block all of the bad eicosanoids. One group of particularly bad eicosanoids, called leukotrienes, is not blocked. In Chapter 6, I discussed several studies that indicated that persons who took non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs had a lower incidence of Alzheimer's disease. It is my opinion that these drugs block bad eicosanoid production. Remember, during this process of eicosanoid production, massive free radicals are also formed. This adds significantly to the damage done by excitotoxins. Drugs that block bad eicosanoid production also block much of the free radical production as well. One of the most effective ways to block the production of harmful eicosanoids is to prevent the initial release of arachidonic acid from the cell wall, which begins the cascade of destruction within the cell. The enzyme that releases arachidonic acid is called phospholipase A2. Two drugs that block this enzyme are quinacrine and 4-bromophenacylbromide, BPB. Experimentally, quinacrine can reduce toxicity caused by arachidonic acid by 92% and BPB by 68%. Protection can also be obtained by attacking steps further down the line in this destructive reaction. The lipoxygenase enzyme stimulates the production of a series of harmful substances called leukotrienes. Inhibitors of this enzyme, such as norepinephrine acid, NDGA, and phenidone, can reduce glutamate damage by 97% and 62%, respectively. In fact, giving NDGA even 12 hours after glutamate will completely block any further toxicity. Recent research has uncovered a very interesting group of compounds called 21-aminosteroids. One of the earlier of this group, designated U74006F, trialazide mesylate, is known to be a potent antioxidant and lipid peroxidation inhibitor, both of which appear to play a central role in neurodegenerative diseases. A newer generation 21-aminosteroid, designated U89678, appears to be even more potent in its protection of neurons. In a recent clinical trial, it was found that subarachnoid hemorrhage patients, usually caused by ruptured aneurysms, experienced a significantly lower death rate and improved recovery when given the drug. A more recent study found that the newer compound could not only significantly block iron-induced lipid peroxidation injury to neurons, but could actually reduce damage to the blood-brain barrier by as much as 60%. This would protect the brain from glutamate and aspartate in the bloodstream. In the first edition of Excitotoxins, I only mentioned a class of glutamate receptors called the metabotropic receptors in passing, but recent research has shed much more light on this important class of glutamate receptors. We now know that there are at least three types of metabotropic receptors, called types 1, 2, and 3. Overactivity of type 1 appears to be associated with excitotoxic lesions to the brain. There is growing evidence that this class of receptor plays a major role in Parkinson's disease. Blocking this receptor with drugs appears to be neuroprotective, but types 2 and 3 metabotropic receptors have an opposite effect. Activation of these receptors seems actually to protect specific brain cells. That is, drugs which stimulate these receptors are neuroprotective. While the field of neuroprotection is relatively new, it is growing increasingly sophisticated. Other avenues being explored are a group of phospholipids normally found in the brain called gangliosides. Early experiments seem to indicate that they may prevent, to some degree, glutamate damage to the brain. Another group of naturally occurring substances being explored as neuroprotectants is called nerve growth factors. Nutritional protection. The area of nutritional protection is a wide open field. Unfortunately, the pharmaceutical industry has little interest in this area, since many of these useful compounds cannot be patented, as they are found commonly in nature. In general, besides reducing the concentration of excitotoxins themselves, there are three major areas in which nutritional supplements may help in preventing damage by excitotoxins. 1. Reducing the production of bad eicosanoids. 2. Reducing free radical damage. And 3. Improving energy production. Reducing bad eicosanoids. Enter the zone. I took this subtitle from an important book written by Dr. Barry Sears called The Zone, A Dietary Roadmap. When I read his book, I realized that Dr. Sears had discovered an important piece of the puzzle that could explain a multitude of disorders involved in the connection between hypoglycemia, insulin, and bad eicosanoid production. He makes the important point that one of our major nutritional myths is that we need to consume a large amount of carbohydrates to remain healthy. In fact, he shows just the opposite. Not only is most of our obesity related to carbohydrate excess, but many of the diseases that plague our society, such as cancer, arthritis, and cardiovascular diseases, are also related to this unhealthy practice. Not only should we reduce our carbohydrate intake, but we should also carefully select the type of carbohydrates that we do eat. Only recently did anyone ask the question, are all carbohydrates equal in terms of absorption from the gut? The answer turned out to be no. Carbohydrates are absorbed at highly variable rates. Some are absorbed very rapidly, and others relatively slowly. So why would this matter? Because the rate of absorption of carbohydrates determines the amount of insulin secreted in response from the pancreas. Carbohydrates rapidly absorbed by the gut flood the bloodstream with glucose. All carbohydrates are converted to glucose. To handle this sudden load of sugar, the pancreas has to secrete a large amount of insulin. In 60 million Americans, there is a significant overshoot of insulin that, in turn, drives the blood sugar to levels that impair brain function. We experience this overshoot by intense hunger, tremulousness, and anxiety. But what Dr. Sears has shown is that the excess insulin also stimulates the production of bad eicosanoids, which severely damage cells, including brain cells. We know that hypoglycemia causes the brain to secrete internally excess amounts of glutamate, especially aspartate. Further, as we have seen, these excitotoxins also stimulate the production of bad eicosanoids. At least two major studies have shown that the majority of Alzheimer's patients have hyperinsulinemia and hypoglycemia. The question that remains unanswered is, will altering the diet early in life prevent such neurodegenerative diseases? Dr. Sears makes the important point that food should be viewed as a very powerful drug. Another approach to reducing the amounts of bad eicosanoids is limiting its precursor substance, arachidonic acid, in the diet. This can be done by avoiding egg yolks, organ meats, liver and most deli meats, and red meats. It is also critical that you maintain a low-fat diet, especially saturated fats, since these can produce a state of insulin resistance. Insulin resistance means that the cell will not respond to insulin, even in very high concentrations. This is believed to be the cause of adult-onset diabetes, type 2 diabetes. Omega-3 fatty acids. The majority of fats in the American diet consist of what are called omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acids. This includes the essential fatty acids linoleic and linolenic acids, which are high in corn, cotton, soya, safflower, and sunflower oils. While the popular trend initiated by the American Heart Association promotes the use of polyunsaturated oils, there is growing evidence that these oils promote the generation of bad as well as good eicosanoids. In fact, there is significant evidence that these oils may actually promote arteriosclerosis and therefore coronary artery disease and strokes. Omega-3 fatty acids are derived primarily from cold water fish. When the diet consists of a high proportion of these oils, the generation of arachidonic acid is significantly reduced, thereby reducing the generation of bad eicosanoids. Experimental animal and human studies have both demonstrated a significant reduction in blood coagulation, and hence in the incidence of both strokes and heart attacks. We know that cell membranes are critical in receptor function, ion exchange, enzyme function, and nutrient entry into the cell. With aging, the cell membranes lose some of their fluidity, and as a result, these critical functions are impaired. It has been shown that omega-3 fatty acids can improve cell membrane fluidity. It is also known that dietary omega-3 fatty acid can change the composition of the cell membranes in a short period of time, so that the major component of the membrane lipids are then comprised of the two types of oils found in fish oils, mainly eicosapentaenoic acid, EPA, and docosahexaenoic acid, DHA. These particular oils inhibit the production of arachidonic acid within the cell membrane. It is the activation and release of arachidonic acid from the cell membrane that triggers the production of eicosanoids, resulting in the production of prostaglandins and leukotrienes. Many of these products are quite toxic to cells and can generate massive amounts of free radicals, leading to damage to the cell's membranes as well as its genetic structure. As we have seen, this process plays a critical role in glutamate toxicity. The bottom line is that omega-3 fatty acids, fish oils, can block the production of bad-type eicosanoids. Other studies have shown that feeding omega-3 fatty acids to animals can significantly improve nerve conduction within the optic nerve. While no one has measured it, one could safely assume that neural conduction within other parts of the nervous system would improve as well. It is important to buy only quality products, free of pesticide residues and mercury. Some brands have high concentrations of omega-3 fatty acids and should be preferred. Another warning, always keep your capsules in the refrigerator. Omega-3 fatty acids are unsaturated and subject to rancid destruction. Because of this, I would recommend taking at least 400 international units of alpha-tocopherol per day with your capsules. Effects of aging on the brain. Free radicals. It is now known that as we age, our cells, including neurons, lose a significant amount of their ability to generate energy. As you will recall, most cells generate the majority of their energy from electrons passing through a series of enzymatic reactions within the mitochondria, known as the electron transport chain. These electrons are derived from the breakdown of glucose in Krebs cycle. The various steps in energy generation by the electron transport chain have been designated complex 1 through 5. Anything which blocks one of these enzymatic steps severely interferes with the cell's ability to produce energy, primarily in the form of ATP. But to understand better how energy deficits occur, we must go back one more step. Even before energy production declines, another process begins to develop. As we age, the cells begin to accumulate free radicals in larger amounts. We know that free radicals can damage cell membranes, intracellular components, and even the DNA itself. One reason for this gradual and increasing accumulation of free radicals is the reduction in the cell's protective mechanisms. For example, we know that all cells contain three antioxidant enzymes, glutathione, catalase, and superoxide dismutase, as well as a multitude of scavenging vitamins and minerals, vitamin C, E, D, K, beta-carotene, selenium, magnesium, and zinc. In fact, even coenzyme Q10 acts as a powerful free radical scavenger, and a regenerator of antioxidants, vitamin C and E. As we age, there is a progressive decline in reduced glutathione, as well as the other antioxidants within the cellular environment. In part, this is due to the increased production of several oxygen radicals, such as superoxide and the hydroxide radical, which in essence overwhelm the antioxidant enzymes. A combination of decreased availability of the antioxidant enzymes, depletion of the dietary antioxidants, and increased generation of free radicals puts all cells at considerable risk of serious injury or death. In humans, we know that lipid peroxidation, a process of free radical injury to cell membrane lipids, results in the accumulation of age pigments within the brain called lipofuscin. Animals fed diets low in vitamin E develop a dramatic increase in these age pigments. Vitamin E supplementation markedly reduces brain lipofuscin. One of the early findings in Parkinson's disease, as you will recall, is a dramatic fall in the glutathione levels within the neurons of the primary area of the brain affected, the substantia nigra. This is accompanied by a buildup of peroxides and the dangerous hydroxide radical. Iron accumulation within these affected neurons acts as a powerful free radical generator as well. A recent study also indicated that there may be an accumulation of copper in addition to iron. Copper, too, is a powerful generator of free radicals. Interestingly, iron is also known to be increased in the frontal lobes in cases of Alzheimer's disease. And, as one would expect, there is an increase in lipid peroxidation in cases of Alzheimer's disease. Microscopically, free iron seems to concentrate in and around the neuritic plaques, common to Alzheimer's disease patients. Others have reported a significant reduction in brain levels of vitamin E, A, and carotenoids in autopsied cases of the disease. The buildup of free radicals within the neurons with aging not only affects energy production, complex 1 is especially sensitive to damage by free radicals, but also produces severe damage to the mitochondrial DNA. Cells, you see, possess two types of genetic material, one found in the nucleus, that most think of, and another within the mitochondria. The latter is responsible for reproduction of the mitochondria within the cell. Damage to mitochondrial DNA affects only the involved mitochondria and not the genetics of the cell itself. But when that mitochondria reproduces itself, the defect is passed on to the new mitochondria as well. Today, we know that there is a growing list of diseases caused by mitochondrial malfunction. We know that many of these diseases do not present themselves until later childhood or even adulthood. The explanation for this delay may lie in the fact that until greater than 60% of the mitochondria are affected, no disease occurs. That may take many years or even decades. It is known that mitochondrial DNA mutates at a rate 10 times that of chromosomal DNA. Most likely, this is because the former lacks histones and repair enzymes. In the first study of its kind, Dr. Alan C. Bowling and co-workers demonstrated an age-dependent impairment of electron transport chain enzymes in the primate cortex. They found that complex 1 and 4 in the brain were especially vulnerable to age-related damage. These are the same two complexes damaged in Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and Huntington's disorder. A portion of these two complexes are encoded in the mitochondrial DNA. Complex 2, 3, and 5 were preserved, not surprisingly, since they are encoded by the chromosomal DNA only. Complex 1 is known to be very sensitive to destruction by the hydroxyl radical and complex 4 to peroxide. It is also of interest to note that glutamate not only damages the microtubules within the dendrites, even in sublethal doses, but it also damages the DNA as well. Dr. S.E. Shepherd and co-workers, in a most important research study, found that aspartame, NutraSweet, when nitrosated in the stomach, shows a significant mutagenicity, causing damage to the genetic structure of the cell. In fact, they found that the nitrosated aspartame was quite toxic to cells themselves. Protecting our neurons from free radicals. Since the primary defect causing neurons to have difficulty generating energy is related to free radical generation, our primary concern should be in how to restore the cell's ability to combat these accumulating free radicals. There are, in fact, several things that we can do. N-acetyl-L-cysteine, NAC. In the first edition of Excitotoxins, The Taste That Kills, the relation between L-cysteine and excitotoxic brain injury was covered. Since then, a multitude of people have called or written to ask if N-acetyl-L-cysteine is also an excitotoxin. So here it is. N-acetyl-L-cysteine is not an excitotoxin, and even in high doses does not seem to damage the brain. L-cysteine produces its damage by converting to cysteine sulfenic acid and cysteic acid, both of which are excitotoxins. Remember, excitotoxins produce their damage only when outside the cell, in the extracellular space. N-acetyl-L-cysteine enters the cell and is converted to glutathione, a powerful antioxidant enzyme. A multitude of studies have shown that NAC can significantly elevate glutathione levels in the tissues, including brain tissues. Not only can glutathione neutralize one of the most powerful of the free radicals, the hydroxyl radical, it can also regenerate the free radical scavenging power of vitamin C as well. When vitamins C and E are exposed to free radicals, they are oxidized and may become free radicals themselves. They must be reduced before they can become effective free radical scavengers once again. While N-acetyl-L-cysteine appears to be safe, even in large doses, 4 to 6 grams, more study is needed to assure its long-term safety. There may be better and safer ways to increase intracellular glutathione. Single antioxidant vitamins versus multiple vitamins. Another frequently asked question is, would it be better to take a single antioxidant vitamin in high doses or several types of antioxidants in lower doses, since they all seem to do the same thing? The answer is that it is better to take several different types of antioxidants. There are many different types of free radicals, peroxides, hydroxide radical, superoxide, and singlet oxygen, for example. The antioxidants each specialize in removing specific types of free radicals. For example, vitamin E scavenges the superoxide radical, hydroxyl radical, and acts as a chain-breaking agent in the propagation phase of lipid peroxidation. But for most forms of vitamin E, it does so only in the lipid fractions of the cell, that is, the fatty membranes. Water-soluble vitamin E appears to concentrate in the cytosol of the cell as well. Coenzyme Q10, on the other hand, blocks both the initiation as well as the propagation of lipid peroxidation. Vitamin C and beta-carotene block free radicals within the watery parts of the cell, cytosol, and in the space outside the cell, extracellular space, but not in the lipid membranes. Also important to consider is the fact that vitamin C and coenzyme Q10 can recycle vitamin E, thereby restoring its antioxidant function. Glutathione recycles vitamin C. It is for these reasons that the antioxidant vitamins and minerals should be taken in combination. Clinical studies, as well as experimental animal studies, confirm this observation. Excitotoxins as free radical generators. It needs to be emphasized that all excitotoxins, glutamate, aspartate, and L-cysteine, stimulate large amounts of free radicals within exposed neurons. In fact, in a recent paper, Catherine Bergeron stated that the best theory for excitotoxicity in ALS was that it initiated oxidative stress and the arachidonic cascade by phospholipase A2, thereby generating enormous and overwhelming concentrations of free radicals in the anterior horn cells of the spinal cord. This, in time, results in the progressive death of these motor neurons and the onset of progressive weakness. Similar scenarios are carried out in the other neurodegenerative diseases, such as Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and Huntington's disease. In all cases, we know that excess excitotoxic stimulation results in the buildup of free radicals within the involved neurons, eventually overwhelming the cell's ability to neutralize these harmful particles. Directly stimulating mitochondrial energy production. Once the problem of excess free radical generation is corrected, we are still left with damaged mitochondria that are unable to produce a sufficient amount of energy for normal functioning and survival. A growing list of mitochondrial diseases is being recognized. Treatment of these diseases, until recently, has been hopeless. What changed all of this was the realization that these are metabolic defects, and that by manipulating the cell's metabolism, one might correct some of these defects. One of the early treatments involved using riboflavin and L-carnitine. The results were quite surprising and gratifying. Many patients improved and for the first time became functionally independent. Coenzyme Q10 plus niacinamide. We know that certain mitochondrial toxins can mimic these disorders. Dr. Flint Beal and colleagues, using animals, found that if these animals were given a mitochondrial toxin, they consistently developed lesions deep in their brains. But if the animals were pre-treated with a combination of coenzyme Q10 and niacinamide, the lesions could be prevented. Coenzyme Q10 alone could prevent these neurons from losing their ATP energy molecules, but could not prevent cell death. But by combining it with niacinamide, there was a significant increase in brain cell ATP levels, thereby preventing excitotoxic damage. It is my own personal feeling that riboflavin and thiamine would also boost ATP production to an even greater degree when added to coenzyme Q10 and niacinamide. The dosage used in most studies was 100 milligrams of each and 120 milligrams of coenzyme Q10. Acetyl-L-carnitine. This compound is a derivative of L-carnitine, a natural biochemical component of all cells. It differs in that it enters the cell easier and provides an acetyl group for the production of the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. In fact, acetyl-L-carnitine has neurotransmitter properties much like acetylcholine. This remarkable compound has several useful properties. It is an antioxidant, it increases mitochondrial energy production, it stabilizes cell membranes, increases cholinergic transmission in the brain, involved in memory, and chelates iron. Experimentally, it has been shown to reverse hippocampal and prefrontal loss of neurons associated with aging, and significantly reduces lipofuscin pigment, age pigment, accumulation. In addition, acetyl-L-carnitine reduces the receptor loss associated with aging of the brain, and significantly improves learning and memory in aged animals and humans. If all this is not enough, this remarkable compound has also been shown to defend brain cells against lipid peroxidation and increase cellular glutathione and ubiquinol, coenzyme Q10, concentration. In Chapter 5, I explained how a chemical accidentally manufactured during the production of illicit drugs, called MPTP, produced a sudden explosive onset of full-blown Parkinson's disease in hundreds of young people. It is now known that acetyl-L-carnitine can block certain aspects of MPTP toxicity and restore the reduced glutathione in the affected substantia nigra neurons. In addition, this compound can increase the inhibitory neurotransmitter GABA, which protects neurons against excess stimulation. Glutamic acid moderately inhibits acetyl-L-carnitine uptake into the brain. This is another reason to avoid MSG in your food. Incredibly, I believe this remarkable yet expensive compound may safely be used in doses of 3 to 4 grams a day. L-carnitine. I am often asked if L-carnitine can do the same things as acetyl-L-carnitine. Unfortunately, it cannot, but it can do some pretty important things in terms of protecting the brain. For example, in the aging brains of rats, it has been demonstrated to reduce the deteriorating histological changes as well as slow down behavioral deterioration. L-carnitine improves long-term memory, discriminatory learning, and spatial learning, and seems to extend longevity. Most importantly, L-carnitine significantly improves cellular energy production, including that in brain cells. One thing L-carnitine cannot do that acetyl-L-carnitine can do is increase cellular glutathione levels. Also, acetyl-L-carnitine is much better absorbed by neurons than is L-carnitine. One important property of L-carnitine is that it has been shown to reduce glutamate toxicity in a dose-dependent fashion. That is, the higher dose of L-carnitine, the better the protection. As for safety, L-carnitine has few side effects. In some individuals, higher doses, 2 or more grams, can induce diarrhea. Taurine. Taurine is an amino acid found in high concentrations in the brain and appears to function as a neuromodulator in the nervous system. A neuromodulator is a substance that controls other neurotransmitters by preventing too great a response. In essence, its function is to protect the brain. We know that taurine plays a major role in stabilizing nervous system excitability. The highest concentrations are found in the pituitary and pineal glands, the retina, cerebellum, olfactory bulb, and the striatum. One experiment that makes the case for the importance of taurine in protecting the brain was conducted using cats. Two sets of cats were fed an identical concentration of L-cysteine, but one group was fed a taurine-free diet and the other was given a small amount of taurine. All 9 cats fed the taurine-free diet plus the 5% L-cysteine developed lethargy, inability to stand, rigidity of the neck and lower limbs, epileptic seizures, and eventually died. The cats fed a diet containing a small amount of taurine plus the L-cysteine showed only minimal symptoms or were symptom-free. None died. The animals were followed for years. By adding taurine to tissues exposed to the excitotoxins kynic acid and quinolinic acid, complete protection could be afforded. Infant diets and tube feedings used for hospitalized patients until recently were without taurine. Because of the strong association between brain damage and excitotoxins, manufacturers are now adding taurine to infant feedings. Conclusions. It is becoming increasingly evident that many, if not all, of the neurodegenerative diseases of the central nervous system begin with an impaired energy production system. This leaves the neuron vulnerable to excitotoxin injury. By using nutritional products to increase mitochondrial energy production, this final destructive step is avoided. Interestingly, L-carnitine and acetyl-L-carnitine can bypass the defect in complex 1 that I have seen in Parkinson's disease and Huntington's disease. Riboflavin, niacinamide, thiamine, and vitamin K also improve mitochondrial energy production in cases of poor energy generation by the cells. A new compound on the scene, alpha-lipoic acid, holds even more promise. Further improving brain function nutritionally. Phosphatidylcholine, lecithin. The nervous system consists of a multitude of complex phosphorus-containing lipids, such as sphingomyelin, gangliosides, and cerebrosides. Not only do they form the insulation of the nerve pathways, myelin sheath, but they also make up the majority of the cell membranes. One of the popular products sold in health food stores to improve memory function is lecithin. While in biochemical terms, lecithin is synonymous with phosphatidylcholine, in preparations it is a combination of phosphatidylcholine, phosphatidylethanolamine, and phosphatidylserine. Pure phosphatidylcholine is thought to improve memory by increasing the availability of choline for the production of the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. While acetylcholine has many functions in the brain as a neurotransmitter, it does play a major role in various aspects of memory. Several experiments have shown that even in normal individuals, phosphatidylcholine can improve memory. Experiments using this product to treat Alzheimer's patients have met with some minor success. The results are better when lecithin is combined with choline. There is also interest in using lecithin to repair injuries to the insulation of nerves in cases of multiple sclerosis, trigeminal neuralgia, stroke, and head injury, for example. I have used lecithin in cases of brain injuries and strokes and have seen a significant improvement in these patients' outcomes. Others have reported similar results. Lecithin capsules should be kept in the refrigerator at all times to prevent spoilage. It also makes them more palatable. Phosphatidylserine. While previously all the attention has been given to its biochemical cousin, phosphatidylcholine, this phospholipid is being shown to have superior neurological properties. When fed to aging animals, it has been shown to improve their passive-active avoidance reaction, spatial memory, and other learning and memory tasks significantly. In a recent study involving men 50 years or older suffering from serious memory loss not caused by Alzheimer's disease, it was found that giving 300 milligrams of phosphatidylserine a day for 3 months significantly improved their memory function as measured by an extensive battery of tests. Improvement was seen within 3 weeks of taking the product, especially regarding name and face recognition and recall, telephone number recall, and misplaced object recall. Another interesting effect was the fact that these memory-impaired men showed significant improvement in their ability to remember the details of a story that was read. The exact mechanism for this improvement is not known, but it is known that phosphatidylserine is a natural glutamate blocker. It has also been shown to improve cell membrane stability and fluidity. As we age, our cell membranes become stiffer, interfering with their normal operation in a multitude of functions, such as electrolyte exchange gradients, receptor function, and impulse generation. Phosphatidylserine appears to restore a more youthful composition to these vital membranes. This intriguing compound has also shown promise in Alzheimer's patients, most improved on several measures of cognitive functions, and the result appeared to be most dramatic in those having earlier stages of the disease. Phosphatidylserine appears to be safe. Its only drawback is that it is very expensive. I would warn the reader to avoid products made from animal brains. Dehydroergot compounds. Hydrogen. Hydrogen is a combination product derived from a rye fungus, Claviceps purpurea. The altered and purified form, called hydrogen, is manufactured by the Sandoz Pharmaceutical Company. It is composed of three ergot compounds, dihydroergocornine, dihydroergocrystine mesylate, and dihydroergocryptine mesylate. This group of compounds has useful properties in counteracting the effects of aging on the brain. It is known to increase brain blood flow as well as oxygen delivery and acts as a free radical scavenger. Clinical studies have demonstrated improved alertness and higher levels of intellectual function in young, healthy individuals. One of the more interesting properties of hydrogen is its effect on the cAMP second messenger system within brain cells. These are chemical messengers that travel within the cell by delivering information between neurotransmitters, hormones, and neuromodulators, and the components within the cell. Hydrogen interacts with cAMP in a way so as to prevent its level from falling too low or going too high. This is important in that it helps economize the brain's ATP levels, thereby preventing a sudden drain on brain energy reserves during times of stress. It is suspected that in the aged brain, stress-precipitated release of catecholamine hormones, epinephrine and norepinephrine, may tax the neuron's energy-generating machinery to the point that it can no longer compensate for the demand. This can result in energy depletion and subject the neuron to excitotoxic injury or even eventual death. Hydrogen inhibits catecholamine stimulation of the neuron's metabolism. Another, perhaps even more important response, is hydrogen's effect on membrane stability. As previously stated, aging severely impairs the cell membrane's composition, resulting in a multitude of problems. As with any medication, consult your physician for dosage. DMAE, Dienol. Dimethylaminoethanol, DMAE, or Dienol, is a natural substance found in anchovies and sardines, and, to a limited extent, in the brain itself. DMAE is known to increase the production of choline in the brain, and as a result, increases the brain's production of acetylcholine. Early reports found that DMAE produced a sense of mood elevation and improved memory and learning ability, even in the young. In one large study involving behavioral problems in children, it was found that DMAE supplementation reduced hyperactivity, increased attention span, and reduced irritability in 76% of girls and 66% of boys. It may offer a better alternative than Ritalin in cases of attention deficit disorder. The beneficial effects of DMAE usually require 2 to 3 weeks of supplementation. In most studies, maximal benefit was attained at least by 6 months. There are several reports of DMAE reducing daytime fatigue and giving one a sense of having more energy. Not only is sleep often sounder, but many report that individuals may require less sleep than before supplementation. As with the other compounds, DMAE appears to stabilize cell membranes. Side effects are usually limited to spasms of the neck and jaw. Stabilizing the blood-brain barrier. The items mentioned constitute a short list of supplements that have shown particular value in reversing the effects of aging on the brain and may offer protection from excitotoxin damage. There is a growing list of compounds and drugs that may offer even greater results. Finally, I would like to mention one other area of protection that is purely theoretical, but is backed up by strong research evidence, and that is nutritional products that may strengthen the blood-brain barrier. It was a gentleman by the name of Bill Sardi who focused my attention on the concept and presented me with some startling research. Bill wrote a very interesting book entitled Nutrition and the Eyes, but it was the second part of a 2-part article he wrote for the Townsend Newsletter for Doctors that attracted my attention. Then, much to my surprise, Bill wrote to me and we discussed some of these ideas. So, how is this connected to the brain? Embryologically, the eyes develop as special extensions of the brain. And, like the brain, the eyes have their own blood barrier system, much like the blood-brain barrier. What Bill showed was that a special group of nutritional compounds tend to protect the eyes from damage by disease and from the changes of aging. These compounds are commonly known as flavonoids, or bioflavonoids. A multitude of reports demonstrate that several of the flavones, quercetin, rutin, and the flavonone hesperidin, can significantly protect this retinal barrier and improve the strength of the capillaries in the eye. One would assume, since they have the same composition, that the blood-brain barrier would likewise be strengthened by flavone-flavonone supplementation. In general, these compounds are relatively cheap and non-toxic. It would be worthwhile to supplement those in danger of barrier disruption, such as hypertensives, diabetics, and those with multiple sclerosis. Two of the flavonone substances are of particular interest, quercetin and hesperidin. Both have been shown to be significant inhibitors of the eicosanoid-generating enzyme, delta-lipoxygenase. Quercetin was found to be a potent and prolonged inhibitor of pro-inflammatory arachidonic acid metabolism. Hesperidin, at higher concentrations, was found to inhibit the enzyme phospholipase A2, responsible for release of arachidonic acid. This could not only be important in protecting the integrity of the blood-brain barrier, but in protecting the cells of the brain from excitotoxic damage, since it uses the same pathways. Alpha-lipoic acid, is it a miracle nutrient? Alpha-lipoic acid, also called thioctic acid, is a natural component of tissues throughout the body. It has a multitude of functions, many of which play an important role in protecting the body against free radicals, heavy metal toxicity, and a number of age-related destructive changes in cells and tissues. It appears to be the reduced form of alpha-lipoic acid, called dihydrolipoic acid, or DHLA, that plays such a vital role in neutralizing free radicals. Scientists consider the ideal universal antioxidant to have some of the following properties. 1. It should have a specific activity against free radicals. 2. It should chelate or bind oxygen-reactive metals. 3. It should interact with other antioxidants. 4. It should have maximal absorption from the gut and be easily available to all tissues, bioavailable. 5. It should be able to enter both the membrane, lipid domain, and the cytosol, aqueous domain. Reduced alpha-lipoic acid, DHLA, appears to meet virtually all of these criteria, making it a universal antioxidant. As we have learned, one of the most potent free radicals known is the hydroxyl radical. DHLA not only scavenges this dangerous radical, but also removes hypochlorous acid, singlet oxygen, and the superoxide radical. Another way DHLA reduces free radical formation is by its ability to chelate free iron and copper, both of which are very powerful free radical generators. It can scavenge the peroxyl radical, and has been shown to protect DNA from single-strand breaks caused by singlet oxygen. One of the more interesting and vitally important characteristics of DHLA is that it appears to be able to regenerate other antioxidants. As mentioned before, when vitamins C and E are used to neutralize free radicals, they themselves become oxidized. To be used as antioxidants, they must be returned to a reduced form. DHLA is a powerful regenerator of reduced ascorbate and tocopherol. It is this continuous process of recycling of vitamin C and E to their reduced form by DHLA that prevents the cell membrane from undergoing destructive lipid peroxidation. Alpha-lipoic acid has been shown to prevent the symptoms of both vitamin C and E deficiency. Alpha-lipoic acid is also known to increase the levels of ubiquinol, coenzyme Q10, during times of oxygen stress, free radical buildup. In addition, alpha-lipoic acid increases intracellular glutathione, another powerful antioxidant. As for bioavailability, following dietary supplementation, both alpha-lipoic acid and DHLA increase in all tissues. Besides its function as a free radical scavenger and regenerator of other antioxidants, alpha-lipoic acid has also been shown to enhance glucose transport into cells as well, even without insulin. Normally, glucose cannot enter a cell, except in the brain, unless insulin is present. What makes this especially important is that this could play a vital role in treating both forms of diabetes, type 1 or juvenile onset, and type 2, adult onset. Clinical studies with alpha-lipoic acid and DHLA. The clinical studies using these two compounds have been very encouraging. In one study of people having type 2 diabetes, alpha-lipoic acid was shown to enhance glucose utilization by 50%. Another area of interest is in dealing with the complication of diabetes, particularly polyneuropathy and cataracts. Diabetic polyneuropathy is a disorder of the nerves in the arms and especially in the legs, causing severe burning pains and numbness, and sometimes affecting bladder and bowel function. The pains are quite incapacitating. Studies on patients having this disorder have shown that the majority have shown significant improvement of their symptoms on alpha-lipoic acid supplementation. Cataracts are known to be related to free radical damage to the lens of the eye. Experimental studies using chemicals that induce cataracts in rats demonstrated that alpha-lipoic acid prevented cataract formation. Examination of the lenses of the supplemented animals also demonstrated significant elevations in glutathione, ascorbate, and vitamin E. It is known that when the blood supply to the brain is temporarily cut off and then restored minutes later, the brain is flooded with free radicals, often leading to death of the animals. This would mimic the clinical situation seen with persons suffering from a sudden and prolonged cardiac arrest or from a massive stroke. Normally, the mortality from such experiments is as high as 80%, but when animals are pre-treated with alpha-lipoic acid, the mortality falls to 20%. This remarkable lowering of death rates in animals receiving alpha-lipoic acid is in part due to improved glutathione concentrations in the brain and the resulting reduction in lipid peroxidation. Another effect of alpha-lipoic acid is its effect on the aging brain. In one study of memory loss seen in aging mice, alpha-lipoic acid supplementation improved performance to such an extent that 24 hours later, the aged animals were performing better than the young animals. Yet, when given to the younger animals, it did not improve their memory. It is tempting to think that the improved mental function in the aged brain may be secondary to the improved passage of glucose into the brain, past dysfunctional glucose transporters. Recently, Greenemeier and co-workers found that by treating animals with alpha-lipoic acid or DHLA for 7 days, they could significantly reduce, by 50%, either directly or indirectly, excitotoxic lesions caused by injecting a powerful excitotoxin or metabolic inhibitor deep into the brain. The mechanism could be by alpha-lipoic acid's ability to either improve brain energy metabolism or by its antioxidant effect, or both. Alpha-lipoic acid, but not DHLA, was discovered to give profound protection against radiation injury to the blood-forming tissues, hematopoietic tissue, in mice. Survival in heavily irradiated mice increased from 35% to 90% when they were treated with alpha-lipoic acid. And in one of the largest human experiments in radiation exposure, the Chernobyl disaster, it was found that thousands of children, as well as adults, were living in zones of constant low-level radiation. These children were found to have high levels of peroxidation products in their blood. But the children treated with alpha-lipoic acid were found to have levels as low as that of unexposed normal children. The addition of vitamin E to the alpha-lipoic acid lowered the levels of peroxidation products even further, while vitamin E alone had no effect. Finally, alpha-lipoic acid, as a metal chelator, has been shown to offer complete protection against mercury poisoning in mice when given in a high dose. Similar protection was also seen in cases of arsenite poisoning in animals. But the dose had to be in a high ratio to the poison. Cadmium poisoning is known to induce cellular membrane damage, lipid peroxidation, and depletion of cellular glutathione. In rats, alpha-lipoic acid was found to prevent cadmium-induced lipid peroxidation in the heart, brain, and testes completely. As you can see, alpha-lipoic acid is truly a remarkable compound. It may hold great promise when used in combination with some of the other supplements in preventing or even reversing the neurodegenerative diseases. More research is needed to answer this important question. Alpha-lipoic acid works best if it is taken on a daily basis, since in several experiments, protection was afforded only if it had been taken well before the damaging event. Most likely, this is because it must be converted to its active reduced form, dihydrolipoic acid, in order to give full protection. The side effects associated with alpha-lipoic acid are usually few and minor. The Germans have been using it in larger doses for many years. Allergic skin reactions are possible, and when given in very large intravenous doses, it may lower the blood sugar to hypoglycemic levels. Part 2. What did the FASEB report really say? In July of 1995, the Life Sciences Research Office of the Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology, FASEB, prepared what was to be a definitive report on the question of safety of monosodium glutamate for the Food and Drug Administration. The report is divided into two major parts, an executive summary prepared by the FDA, followed by the in-depth analysis of the medical and research literature on MSG. The news media never got past the executive summary, which I am sure is what the FDA was counting on. And, as predicted, the evening news announced that the report from the experts on the panel concluded that when less than 3 grams was consumed, MSG appeared to be safe. In the June 1996 issue of Nutrition Today, there is a statement by the Institute of Food Technologists, which uses the very same selective reading done by the major media, giving the reader the impression that the FASEB report gives MSG a clean bill of health. In fact, that is not what the report said at all. The executive summary was couched in very clever terms. For example, on page 6, they make the statement that no evidence exists to support the role of ingested glutamate in the etiology or exacerbation of these or any other long-term or chronic illness. At first look, this seems to say that studies have been conducted to see if there is a causal link between MSG ingestion and worsening of these disorders, and that no link was found. But in truth, as the body of the report makes plain, no such studies have ever been done. No one has examined this vital question. But there is plenty of clinical as well as research evidence to support the very real danger of MSG ingestion in neurodegenerative diseases. I have received calls from several patients suffering from ALS who have told me that their doctors, who staff some of the largest ALS clinics and research centers in the country, confidentially tell them to avoid MSG and aspartame. The reason they are reluctant to go public with this is because they fear ridicule by colleagues and the industry. This is reminiscent of doctors' responses to claims of the beneficial effects of vitamins less than a decade ago. The defenders of MSG safety have always relied on the weak argument that glutamate is excluded from the brain by the blood-brain barrier, but the text of the FASEB report says the opposite. In fact, they cite a recent study done by Bogdanoff and Wertmann, 1994, in which they measured deep brain striate levels of glutamate following a dose of MSG. These researchers found that following the dose of MSG, striate levels of glutamate rose sharply and significantly. Page 29 of the report. In this book, I give three other references that confirm that brain levels of glutamate rise following elevations in blood glutamate. In fact, one researcher found that with chronic ingestion of glutamate, brain levels of glutamate were consistently elevated. This, of course, would more closely imitate the case in humans, since they consume foods high in glutamate over many years, even a lifetime. Then the report confirms something that I discuss in my book, that several areas of the brain possess no blood-brain barrier. The report concludes, "The net result is that certain areas of the brain may be vulnerable to acute, large-magnitude fluctuations in plasma glutamate concentrations because of flooding from adjacent circumventricular organs." Page 29. The report ignored the multitude of clinical conditions in which the blood-brain barrier can be damaged, such as during hypertension, diabetes, stroke, Alzheimer's disease, and head injury. On page 43 of the report, the expert panel notes that the nucleus solitarius in the brainstem is one area of the brain that might allow glutamate from the blood to affect the rest of the brain, since this nucleus regulates the blood vessels to the rest of the brain. Also, this nucleus is not protected by the blood-brain barrier. Again, no one has examined this important question. On page 42, they further state, "In the absence of studies or corroborating evidence linking symptoms or signs of adverse effects, it is not possible to link either acute or chronic consumption of MSG to glutamate-mediated neurodegenerative diseases at this time." Note the two disclaimers, "in the absence of studies" and "at this time." This leaves the expert panel a way out should future studies discover such a link. They further protect themselves by stating on the same page, "Levels of ingested MSG might be sufficient to raise the concentration of blood glutamate and related compounds enough to change the levels of these amino acids in the brain, particularly in the circumventricular areas not protected by the blood-brain barrier." On pages 42 to 43, they go even further when they discuss the lack of protection from the pineal gland. "The elevated levels of glutamate and related compounds would then have adverse neuroexcitatory effects, be neurotoxic, and or initiate a chain of metabolic events that would result in either neurotoxicity or the release of substances that would cause the neurological manifestations reportedly associated with MSG exposure." And on page 100 of the report, they state, "In contrast, glutamate concentrations in the extracellular fluid in brain regions not protected by the blood-brain barrier will closely mirror changes in circulating glutamate concentrations." This is an incredible admission. Are they saying that these areas of the brain not protected by the barrier are unimportant? Is the hypothalamus unimportant? What about the hippocampus? In addition, there is ample evidence that with chronic exposure to MSG in the diet, glutamate will seep from the unprotected parts of the brain into the normally protected areas, sort of a backdoor approach. But the hedging goes even further. On page 46, they say that it is conceivable that the consumption of MSG in genetically or otherwise predisposed individuals can exacerbate a pre-existing neurological condition. So, what are some of these conditions that put people at risk when they ingest MSG? They would include Alzheimer's disease, ALS, Huntington's disease, Parkinson's disease, and olivopontocerebellar degeneration. Does this sound as if the expert panel was saying that MSG added to food is safe? What about brain lesions caused by MSG? The expert panel concluded on page 57 that after reviewing different studies, the weight of the evidence is convincing that MSG causes destructive lesions in the hypothalamus and a reduction in endocrine organ weights in all species studied. What we are talking about here are major alterations in the endocrine system that could result in a multitude of endocrine disorders, such as infertility, menstrual difficulties, polycystic ovaries, and other reproductive problems. The hypothalamus also controls appetite, sleep-wake cycles, immunity, and a host of other vital functions. On page 103, they conclude, theoretically, if blood levels seen in animals as a result of MSG challenge were achieved in humans, similar lesions and/or neuroendocrine effects could be expected to occur. Studies, even by defenders of MSG safety, have shown that, in fact, humans develop blood levels of glutamate much higher than that seen in animals when given MSG in comparable doses. In fact, humans develop blood levels higher than any known species. So, in essence, what they are saying is that hypothalamic lesions in humans would be expected following MSG ingestion. Regarding seizures, on page 65, they note that motor disturbances and changes in seizure threshold have been noted in numerous studies. It is interesting to note that all of the newer anti-seizure medications are glutamate-blocking drugs. On page 66, the expert panel notes that there is convincing evidence that glutamate given to newborn rodents can cause behavioral and neurologic effects. This is discussed extensively in Chapter 4. On pages 64 and 65, they state that there are numerous studies confirming the link between changes in brain chemistry and MSG exposure. This is particularly worrisome in children, since the reported neurochemical changes involve transmitters responsible for learning and memory and behavioral control. The panel found that some infant feeding formulas contain very high levels of free glutamate. This was especially true of formulas made from casein hydrolysates. Today we are seeing MSG and/or aspartame being added to a multitude of child-related food products and medications, such as vitamins, cold preparations, vaccines, and foods. There is sufficient evidence to condemn such an irresponsible practice. More evidence. One extremely interesting part of the FASEB study was the clear demonstration by the expert panel of what can only be described as deception by the defenders of MSG safety. Of even more interest is the fact that these startling revelations, also discussed in this book, are never mentioned in the FDA's executive summary. The most obvious false claim by MSG defenders is that the blood-brain barrier excludes dietary glutamate from the brain. The body of the report points out in numerous citations that the blood-brain barrier can be breached at several sites in the normal brain. See pages 28, 29, 43 through 48, 96, 100, and 104 in the FASEB report. I would especially recommend that the reader study the section on pages 54 and 55, in which the expert panel reviews some of the deceptive tactics used by the defenders of MSG safety. For example, on page 54 is a discussion of the Reynolds et al. Deception that can only be described as scientific fraud. Another method used by the MSG defenders, which was pointed out by the FASEB review, is discussed on page 57. In several papers reviewed by the FASEB panel, the researchers claimed that their studies did not show brain lesions following MSG exposure in test animals, thus giving the impression that Dr. John Olney's work was invalid. But the animals were anesthetized with a drug called ketamine, which is known to be a powerful glutamate blocker. In fact, I use ketamine to block glutamate toxicity in some of my neurosurgical patients. It was a well-known fact that ketamine had this property long before these MSG defenders designed their experiments. One can only conclude that the experiments were designed to have negative results so that the industry could cite them as supporting the safety of MSG. Summary. In conclusion, the actual body of the report is very good and supports much of what is in this book. But the FASEB expert panel did not go far enough. For example, The discussion on effects on the developing brain was severely deficient, especially in light of their finding of very high levels of free glutamate in some infant feeding formulas. I go into much more detail in Chapter 4 of this book. I am also puzzled by the lack of data on actual amounts of glutamate added to processed foods. While several questionable studies on total consumption are cited, it seems to me to be a simple matter to obtain from each industry the actual amounts of glutamate and related excitotoxins that are being added to the foods at the time of processing. This would give us a much more accurate picture of free glutamate in the diet. I was also disappointed in their lack of discussion of the additive effects of excitotoxins in the diet. We know that even subtoxic doses of excitotoxins, when added together, can produce an ultimate toxic dose to the brain. This is especially important in evaluating not only differing forms of MSG in food, but the fact that large amounts of aspartame are also being consumed as well, which adds significantly to the danger. I would have liked to see the expert panel come out with a much stronger condemnation of MSG as a food additive, especially in light of their conclusion that even oral doses of MSG have been shown to cause necrotizing brain damage in the hypothalamus, and further, that microscopically one sees massive cytoplasmic breaks, dissolution of cell contents, and massive cell membrane breaks. Certainly our children deserve better. Since I began the research in writing this book, an incredible amount of new material has surfaced concerning the harmful nature of free excitotoxins within the nervous system. Today, virtually all of the neurodegenerative diseases are now considered to be intimately related to the excitotoxic process. Seizures, headaches, strokes, brain injury, subarachnoid hemorrhage, and developmental brain disorders are all intimately related to excitotoxins. Yet we continue to add tons of free glutamate, aspartate, and cysteine to our food and drink. That is not a rational thing to do. It is my opinion, after reviewing an enormous amount of medical and research literature, that monosodium glutamate, aspartame, and other excitotoxin dietary additives pose an enormous hazard to our health and to the development and normal functioning of the brain. To continue to add enormous amounts of excitotoxins to our food is unconscionable and will lead to suffering and ruined lives for generations to come. The civilized world, especially the United States, has become the largest experimental laboratory in history. The question that begs for an answer is, are we creating a nightmare world? Finally, even though I have discussed a multitude of nutrients and drugs that can provide some protection against excitotoxin damage, I am in no way encouraging you to use these supplements to justify a continued use of excitotoxic food additives. This is especially true for those at high risk for excitotoxic damage and for developing one of the neurodegenerative diseases. Appendix: Hidden Sources of MSG. As discussed previously, the glutamate manufacturers and the processed food industries are always on a quest to disguise MSG added to food. The following is a partial list of the most common names for disguised MSG. Remember also that the powerful excitotoxins aspartate and L-cysteine are frequently added to foods and, according to FDA rules, require no labeling at all. Additives that always contain MSG: monosodium glutamate, hydrolyzed vegetable protein, hydrolyzed plant protein, plant protein extract, sodium caseinate, calcium caseinate, yeast extract, textured protein, autolyzed yeast, hydrolyzed oat flour. Additives that frequently contain MSG: malt extract, malt flavoring, bouillon, broth, stock, flavoring, natural beef or chicken flavoring, seasoning, spices. Additives that may contain MSG or excitotoxins: carrageenan, enzymes, soy protein concentrate, soy protein isolate, whey protein concentrate. Protease enzymes of various sources can release excitotoxin amino acids from food proteins. This concludes the reading of Excitotoxins, The Taste That Kills, by Russell L. Blaylock, M.D.